nyt kun se pahin on takana, niin mä odotan tulevaisuudelta sitä, että mulla ei ole semmoisia elämää uhkaavia huolia ja murheita.
Yhdessä syöpää vastaan, koska meillä on elämä tehtävänä. Dokrates Mehiläinen syöpäsairaala.
Beetlecastin tässä jaksossa kuullaan professori Kenneth Womackin haastattelun toinen osa. Hän on kirjoittanut kirjan Living the Beatles Legend, joka kertoo Beatlesin roudarin ja ystävän Mal Evansin tarinan aina sieltä alusta aivan sinne traagiseen loppuun asti. Nyt olemme päässeet tarinan suurin piirtein puoleen väliin ja Apple-yhtiö tulee vuonna 1968 kuvioon mukaan. Mal Evansilla oli Apple-yhtiössä aika isokin rooli. Kuuntelet siis Beetlecast ja puhetta Beatlesista. Minä olen Mika Lintu ja äänessä on myös Mikko Kangasjärvi.
What happened with Mal when Apple came?
So, another great complicated question. So, at first, Mal and Paul made it up one day. They're sitting together and he says, Mal, I think you should be managing director of Apple.
Great.
Well, he was a good choice for it. And Mal had the skills. And he began to think about this new job, right? He actually created some logos for Apple. Of course, Paul had something else in mind. It's better, actually, but he did create a few logos. Mal began to fashion how he would run the business and do the job. The problem, there was a key problem, though. You know, some people think Mal, he had his critics, and they thought he couldn't handle it. I think intellectually you could handle it. The problem was that they still wanted the other guy. They wanted the other guy who would come pick them up or hang out with them or go to the Bag of Nails and drink with them or, stay up all night with them in the studio. And you can't do both. And something had to give. And eventually, you know, they move in other directions, finally settling on Neil. And consequently, in those later years, you don't see Neil at the studio anymore. They had to get Mal an assistant, Kevin Harrington, to help him out. But at first, he was going to be the guy. Now, interestingly, Mal never gave up on trying to find Apple artists. You know, most of the artists were created. Paul found a few early on. But then, of course, when the breakup occurs, Paul pulls way back from Apple, you know, as far back as you can go. And so he's no longer harvesting new acts. Really, George and Mal are the two guys who come up with the most acts for Apple. You know, they just never really quit. They're even into the 70s, they're the ones working on behalf of Apple.
That's true.
And Neil kind of had to pull back for a while with some substance abuse, but it was really Mal and Neil who were doing it. They believed in, Mal and George, they really believed in the concept, you know, of giving artists a shot. And of course, Mal especially loved Badfinger. And of course, he was right. He was a great talent scout. You know, Peter Asher said, when I spoke to him about this, he said, you know, met up with Mal, he took me out to see them, and I said, Mal, your judgment's right. Those guys are great. And they had only upside, right, with that band.
And he even produced some records.
He produced dozens and dozens of songs for them. And planned to be their manager and the guy who would look after them. But he hit a buzzsaw in a couple of personalities, and this was Mal's weakness. He was so good at dealing with other people, but certain kinds of personalities, the more devious they were, and maybe we're all of us good people are like this, right? We are easy prey for certain kinds of personalities, and Alan Klein was the first one. You know, Alan wanted to fire Mal when he figured out he couldn't fire Mal and Neil. He kind of went into retribution with them, and one of the pieces of retribution was he could take Mal off of Badfinger, and he did. And that was terrible for Badfinger, and it was terrible for Mal, because then he would watch a succession of different kinds of managers work with Badfinger and producers and not really do a good job. They wouldn't understand what Badfinger wanted, but Mal did. And that was one of the great disappointments of Mal's life, is that he wasn't allowed to go on. But by the time, no matter what's a number five single and becoming this international hit, Mal's not allowed to work with them anymore. It's really, that was a tough pill for him to swallow. Or George Harrison asked him to come help him. He did a few sessions, as you, I'm sure you both know, with Badfinger when they did Day After Day at Great Tune. Yeah, that was crushing for Mal to be over there helping out and not be their producer. Yeah. It broke his heart.
One interesting thing that I've learned during the years that Mal and Neil were very close, associated with Beatles, and they were willing to basically die for them. But still, the money, what they got from the Beatles, wasn't really that much.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm of two minds on this.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. Certainly in comparison to what the Beatles and Brian were making, it's nothing. But when you look at laborers of their ilk, they were at the top of the scale by English standards at the time. So when Brian started Mal and Neil, because he started Mal at a higher rate because Mal was getting a good salary from the post office, Neil actually got a raise because of Mal. So every time they would bring somebody on board, that's usually when they would get a raise. Alf Bicknell comes on, I guess, in 64, 65. He wanted a higher rate, so they all got a higher rate. So he raised everybody's salaries. The problem was they lived expensive lives. A, they were living in London, which is historically never been cheap. And they weren't making Beatle money. And then B, they were often living in the Beatles' shadows and a very expensive lifestyle. So it could be pretty tough.
Yeah.
A lot has been made about that. Mal, was running a household with a family and kids. Things got tighter. When you look economically at the history of inflation in England, their pay was really good until it wasn't. And that was about 1971, when there were key shifts, inflection points in the British economy. And the problem was, who was running things in 1971? Even though they didn't work for him, Alan Klein. I tell you, if Brian had lived, he would have seen to it that their salaries had moved up in those key moments when they needed to. They still lived well, though. They had access to petty cash. You know, the Beatles were always generous and would give them things. You know, if they both got cars at one point. So they were living good lives. Could it have been better? Absolutely. If you look at the way Neil's life progresses, you know, he rejoins Apple in late 1975. Mal is poised to do so too. They'd only been out of it since the High Court, I guess it would have been January of 1975 when they ratified the end of the partnership. They'd only been out of business for a little bit of time then. And Neil, when he saw Mal in late 75, told him, you know, they're going to make you whole. We're going to get paid for this whole year. So there was a lot to look forward to. And when you look at Neil's life, you know, if Mal could have hung on, right? Imagine the joy he would have had in seeing those new periods of the Beatles' life and times. They weren't going to leave him behind. They never had. You know, he'd worked for them continuously. The pay did not run out till January 75. And again, they were going to be made whole. It's just Mal, unfortunately, doesn't see January 5th, 1976. It would have been, think about the joys he would have had with the CD releases in 87 and the work that they were doing to rebuild the brand. And of course then Anthology, Beatles One, Beatles Love, you know, Mal, because of life and circumstances and his own choices, was robbed of those kinds of joys. There's a moment that Laura Gross, who worked on the Anthology and was good friends with Neil, and actually was very good friends with Mal in the early 70s. There was a moment when Klaus Voormann brought in the big cover for the anthology, the full painting, right, with all the ancillary bits on it. And in the corner, he had a little yellow sign that said Mal on it. Very small. It's on the cover of the anthology book. You can see it if you look for it. Anyway, they brought it in, and Klaus always loved Mal, and he made sure that was there for him. Mm. And Neil and Laura broke down. You know, they just, Mal should have been there. Their hearts hurt when they saw that.
What happened after the Beatles broke up? I understand that it also, of course, it affected everybody, especially Mal.
Sure, Mal, as we said, sensitive type, right? Part of what happened with Mal was, it was a divorce. John was right when he used that word, and it was three guys being divorced by another guy. It turned out, and the guy wasn't John, it was Paul. Mm. So there comes a point when Paul said something along the lines of, I don't need you anymore. You know, and Mal understood. You know, Paul needed to go his own way. The lawsuit was going to take things a certain way. It broke his heart. But at that point, he was really, having been chiefly Paul's guy, now he was John, George, and Ringo's guy. So he serviced them. He worked all their solo albums. Because Apple was disintegrating, Mal handled the petty cash. So part of Mal's job was to pay all the studio musicians. So when he was in London, he would get a big wad of pound notes. Or if he were in California, where they did so much work in the early 70s, he'd go get $5,000 a day to pay their tab when they went out to dinner. Or, you know, think about how much money that was in 1971 or 72, right? He was constantly afraid that he'd be robbed. He lived in fear. One time he was, and they said, don't worry about it. But Mal, of course, was crushed, being a sensitive guy again. But he would, you know, when they made the Ringo album, he'd come up to Jim Keltner and start counting out money. Or, you know, here you go, Klaus, here's your pay, right? That was his job. And so you consequently see in his diaries, they sort of become these kind of accounting sheets with who's getting what, how many hours they spent at the sessions. Mal would keep track of that. You know, think of how complicated that was with All Things Must Pass. Yeah. You know, which, yeah, so that was his job, morphed into this kind of other thing. He was still doing all the other stuff, you know, making sure they had meals and, you know, maybe weed, definitely weed, but also taking care of their instruments. It was just more complicated because they were no longer just at Abbey Road. They were no longer just at their homes. Now they're more scattered. So Mal's life was more complicated, but he was still doing a lot of the same things.
And your work is based on the material that was given by Mal's family. Eventually, what happened to Mal is that he moved to Los Angeles and he didn't contact his family for a long time. Got a divorce?
Well, no, he never was divorced. Okay. Never even... they were separated only because Mal left England.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
So that you could call it a separation, yeah. But nobody, it was not formal.
Yeah. Okay.
And Mal did keep in touch. He would always call and write. Yeah. I think he didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings, just like he didn't want his feelings hurt. So he lived his life in compartments. And one of those compartments was family, you know, outside of London. And then Mal, when he's with, you know, individual Beatles or the Beatles, you know, during their heyday. So he goes to California. He has a girlfriend. He moves in with his girlfriend. He plans to have these separate lives and to keep the balls in the air, right? Of course, us being men of the world, we know that this is not a possibility, right? And Mal gets found out by his wife.
Okay.
You know, that's not cool with her. Mal calls the kids. He keeps in touch. Every week, if not every day, he's in their lives. But there's a powder keg going off. You know, I mean, it's been hard to be Lily, his wife, for these many years during the Beatle days, missing her husband, the kids not having their father, etc. This is a bridge too far. And it begins to create tensions that will lead to the end of Mal's life. You know, I mean, that he was trying to live in compartments, and
it didn't work out.
It did not work out, right? It's like, you know, the problem about being a liar is you have to keep track of all your lies. That's just too much work. Yeah. And Mal wasn't good at it. You know, he visited England exactly one time after being found out and tried to concoct a scenario where he could keep all of his different lives in motion. And his wife was like, no way, buddy. You know, we're not doing that. And, you know, so he wasn't estranged from his family. I don't know if I'd use that word. He was trying to live these different kinds of lives. I mean, I guess in some ways the Beatles lived different kinds of lives, right? Particularly in the early touring years. I think Mal thought he could too. You know, he had his L.A. life. He had his life with his family. They were all wise to it. Even Gary, on their last family vacation, which would have been in the fall of 1973, he said, "Dad, you're going to leave us, aren't you?" He was sniffing it out, and Mal's like, "No, are you kidding? Of course not. I'd never do that." It was, you know, 2 months later. It was, Mal wasn't the first to try something like this, right? He just was terrible. He was terrible at it.
Because Mal's end is very tragic. It's like almost impossible to imagine what happened. But do we still know what happened?
Oh, absolutely. I've interviewed about 200 folks for this book. I have the police reports. I have the shooting report, which is the report that is carried out later to see if it was what they would call a good shoot or a bad shoot, right? Was, you know, where the cops rightly are checking themselves. And then I also have seen the toxicology. Mal knew what he was doing. He didn't want to live any longer. And it was, you know, now we'd call it suicide by cop, right? He had engineered a situation where he wouldn't survive.
Okay.
And, yeah, he was very self-conscious. He knew what he was doing.
Okay.
And he was, you know, he had always had a love of the Old West and firearms. He was a collector of firearms. He had two or three rifles and maybe pistols in England. And once he moved to the United States, he went about collecting them there, too. And in fact, at one point, he said he wanted to go out in a hail of bullets. They were watching Gunsmoke in California, the old TV show, right? And he said, "That's how I want to go." And he engineered exactly that. You know, he just did not want to live any longer. And like a lot of folks, right, he just needed help. He needed someone to, I mean, he would be a classic case for therapy. John Lennon spoke to him a few days before Mal concocted all of this, and he was trying. He could tell something was up, and he said, "You know, Mal, you can handle this a couple of ways. One, you know, you could work things out with your family." And of course, John, I'm sure, was honest with him, as he was by that point, and said, "I have not been great at this," right? With Julian and Sean, and now in the picture at that point, he said, "It can go one of two ways. You can find a way to, for your life to transition into a new kinds of relationships with your soon to be perhaps ex-wife and your children, or it can go badly." And it went badly.
What is interesting about Mal, of course, now is that now you have seen his diaries, you have seen, you know, what has been written out. What makes Mal's work left behind so important?
So, you know, Mal is ultimately us in a lot of ways. He's a fan. You know, Pete Best said to me, the first thing he said was, Mal, first and foremost, was a fan. I said, don't forget that. And that's the truth. Mal was a fan. He loved the music. He had a front row seat to watch this amazing evolution from Love Me Do to Abbey Road. You know, could not believe his eyes and ears and just adored that incredible record, that contribution to art. It was, you know, his one of his last lines about them was, the Beatles are better than food and drink. And Mal loved to eat and he loved to drink. So think about that. He had big appetites and yet they were better than food and drink. So what you learn from these diaries and the material that Mal leaves behind is sort of what fandom looks like when it's unchecked. You know, when you'll do anything, absolutely anything and beyond, to be around it, you know, and yet still be your own self with your own appetites and desires, etc. It's a fascinating character.
Nyt kun se pahin on takana, niin mä odotan tulevaisuudelta sitä, että mulle ei ole semmosia elämää uhkaavia huolia ja murheita.
Yhdessä syöpää vastaan, koska meillä on elämä tehtävänä. Dokrates Mehiläinen syöpäsairaala.
LähiTapiola tuntee kotien riskit. Saat nyt 30% alennuksen kodin irtaimiston vakuutuksesta. Lue lisää lähitapiola.fi. Palvelun tarjoajat, LähiTapiolan alueyhtiöt. LähiTapiola, samalla puolella.
Katso, näet kuvan. Kuulet kuvan, näet äänen. Siksi audio ja ulkomainonta ovat tutkitusti yhdessä vaikuttavampi kuin mikään muu kahden median yhdistelmä. Katso lisää bauermedia.fi.
Bauer Media. Yhdessä vaikuttavin.
Study. You can't help but love him. My father read the manuscript. It took a couple of years to really knock it into shape, and so he read several versions. And he said something really interesting. He said, you know I shouldn't like Mal. He said, because he does some things that I know are wrong. But, he said, I can't help but love him because he's a loving person. Mm-hmm. You know, misguided at times, but a loving guy. And he said, every time I get to the end, I want it to work out differently. I want Mal to get some help or some other force to intervene and make a difference. And of course it doesn't happen. I mean, I liken it to the Titanic, right? You mean, so many things could have gone wrong, right? And that ship makes it to New York, but it doesn't. Mm. And Mal's kind of like that, you know? He's gonna founder and sink. And maybe always was going to. But what you learn from these materials, and I'm proud that book two will be all of these materials becoming available for other people to study and find other stories in. They'll recognize other aspects of this that will be wonderful that I don't see, you know, and that's okay. They'll find their own Beatles and Mal stories through this material. But they are a wonderful document and another way of seeing this world from Mal's point of view.
It's super interesting.
Yeah.
I'm wordless.
Wordless, yeah.
And you have good words. I've heard them. You have been a fine user of language. Yeah. And the piano.
Thanks. Talking about fandom a little bit, what made you a Beatles fan?
It's the music. It's always the music.
When was that?
It was 1977. I'm not a first-generation fan. I'm just slightly too young, and which is fine. And I had intellectual parents. Still have one of them. And when I discovered them, and I was very interested, and I was already interested in music. I was a player of music and a student of the French horn by this point, you know, which is its own complication. So I'm already thinking deeply about music. He said, well, if you're going to get into these guys, you need to take it seriously. And so he went to the Houston Public Library, and he came back with the stack of whatever Beatles books were available at the time. So I've never really had fandom. I'm not a collector. Maybe have a couple of little items of memorabilia that mean something to me. But I'm really, from that moment, I've always been a thinker of the big why, you know. And it still fascinates me. How and why do these four guys develop an art that will transform and transfix the world? And how do they go from that relatively primitive moment, you know, to the great masterworks of, you know, of the White Album and Abbey Road? How does that happen? I think that's just an interesting question anyway. James Joyce doesn't do that. I'm a student of 20th century British literature. Shakespeare's uneven. It doesn't have that level of concentrated effort and growth. It's really something. And, you know, they may have been, you know, these guys from the backwaters of England or however you want to look at it. But at some point in that process, they become artists and they know it and they're ambitious about it. And, you know, I love teaching the Beatles because I want my students to have that ambition. Whatever their thing is, find it. You know, if it's music, great. If it's writing, great. If it's, being a great accountant, whatever it is, find it and just mine it, right? Work the hell out of it. And I love teaching their story because it has so many wonderful elements and lessons about how, you know, nobody's too small to make a difference in the world. These four guys and Brian and George Martin, you know, pushed over an entire industry. You know, they didn't come at it and work their way up through the ranks. They came sideways and knocked it over and said, you know what, we're doing it differently. how do you like that? It's amazing. You know, I mean, I liken it to, you know, Steve Jobs in the 70s. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a dream about building a computer, and I'm going to do it my way, and I'm going to build it in my garage. And until somebody wants to activate it in the way my vision, we're not doing it. You know, I find that fascinating, and I think it's useful for, particularly since I work in a teaching context, I want my students to enjoy that too, right? And have that inspiration, and then do with it what they will. You know, you can't help but approaching things like a parent, right, as you get older. And so I have that in me. I want to see them be successful. You know, I can't make them be successful, but, you know, I hope that they can have the joy and conundrums and challenges of doing something you really love. Because when you're doing something you really love, right, it's not all happiness and success. It's trial and error. It's problem solving. It's having to rebuild yourself occasionally. You know, and the Beatles are all of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, thank you for just a marvelous event. What a the Beatles happening here has been really something special, you know, and I'm glad it's been able to continue after COVID and find its footing, because it's really special the way you bring people together to think about the Beatles, to have fun with the Beatles, to listen to great Beatles music. That's a special thing. And it's special people will something like that into being. So way to go, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kiitoksia, että kuuntelit Beatlecastia, puhetta Beatlesista, ja tietenkin kiitos Kenneth Womackille, jonka haastattelun äsken kuulimme. Ensi kerralla Beatlecastissa aiheena onkin yhtye nimeltään Wings. Kiitos seurasta. Ensi kertaan minä olen Mika Lintu ja äänessä oli myös Mikko Kangasalo.
Totta kai syöpä pelottaa, mutta usein siitä voi parantua ja aina tilannetta voidaan auttaa.
Ihmiset kohdataan oikeasti ihmisinä. Se antaa lisää toivoa.
Yhdessä syöpää vastaan, koska meillä on elämä tehtävänä. Dokrates Mehiläinen syöpäsairaala.
Katso, näet kuvan. Kuulet kuvan, näet äänen. Siksi audio ja ulkomainonta ovat tutkitusti yhdessä vaikuttavampi kuin mikään muu kahden median yhdistelmä. Katso lisää bauermedia.fi.
Bauer Media. Yhdessä vaikuttavin.